Imagine for a second that you're a federal attorney back in the early 1960s, and you get handed just one single assignment.
Right.
You have to prove that one specific county is discriminating against its minority voters. I mean, it sounds pretty straightforward,
You
right?
would think so, yeah.
But this single lawsuit is going to consume 6,000 hours of your life.
It's just wild to even comprehend that number.
Yeah, 6,000 hours. You're going to spend months in completely hostile territory, just sitting in these dusty basements. You're physically combing through thousands of handwritten, incredibly subjective registration records.
And interviewing terrified locals, too.
Exactly. People who know that just talking to you could cost them their jobs, or honestly, much worse. And after all those thousands of hours, if you somehow manage to win your case in federal court, the local officials will just close the registration office the very next morning.
Right, they'd shut it
They
down.
shut it down, pass a slightly different rule, and force you to start at those 6,000 hours completely over again.
It is, it's a staggering visualization of just a completely broken system.
Yeah.
And those 6,000 hours, that wasn't an exaggeration. That was the actual metric cited by the Supreme Court later on to describe the reality of voting rights litigation before 1965.
Wow.
The federal government was essentially, trying to empty an ocean with a teaspoon.
Well, welcome to this deep dive. Today, we are exploring the unseen civic architecture that governs your life. We're looking specifically at the machinery of American democracy through the lens of the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
It's a massive topic.
It really is. And we've pulled together this fascinating stack of sources for our conversation today. We've got historical summaries from the National Archives, some incredibly detailed legal and legislative advocacy briefs from places like the Brenning Center and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
Right, some really heavy legal analysis in there.
Yeah, and we're also looking at the current legislative tracking of the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act from the Human Rights Campaign. So we're taking all of this and synthesizing it to figure out how this machinery actually works.
Because, that machinery is rarely visible to the public. I mean, we tend to think of voting rights as this settled chapter in a history book.
Right, like we fixed it in the 60s and moved on.
Exactly. But the documents we're analyzing today, they reveal that it's actually a highly active, constantly contested legal framework.
And to you listening, this matters directly to your daily life. I mean, this isn't just about a ballot box.
No, not at all.
The architecture we're talking about today dictates who gets to decide the funding for your local public schools. It determines where your property tax dollars are allocated, how your neighborhood is zoned, and what public services actually reach your street.
The ballot box is really just the first domino in that entire sequence.
That's a great way to put it. So, to understand how that first domino functions today, we kind of have to look at how it was initially designed, right?
Yeah, we have to travel back a bit because the original text of the U.S. Constitution is actually surprisingly quiet on the actual mechanics of voting.
Really? I feel like people assume it's all laid out in there.
You'd think so, but no. It essentially deferred to the individual states. It granted them almost total discretion to determine the qualifications for their own voters.
Which meant the states held basically all the cards.
Right. But then, the Civil War happens, the country is completely fractured, and the federal government is forced to implement this massive structural overhaul.
Reconstruction Amendments.
Exactly. So you get the 13th Amendment, which abolishes slavery except as punishment for a crime.
Right.
Then the 14th Amendment, which establishes citizenship and equal protection.
Hmm.
But the absolute linchpin for our discussion today is the 15th Amendment, which was ratified in 1870.
Okay, so what exactly does the 15th Amendment do on paper?
On paper, the text is remarkably unambiguous. It basically declares that the right to vote cannot be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude.
That sounds pretty definitive.
It does. And crucially, it included an enforcement clause. It gave Congress the explicit constitutional authority to enforce this new right through, quote, appropriate legislation.
So if you're just reading that, it reads like a total victory. You read that and think, well, the issue of voting discrimination was completely resolved in 1870.
Right, problem solved.
But the reality on the ground was, what, a complete circumvention of that constitutional text for almost a century.
Oh, absolutely. Southern states essentially treated the 15th Amendment as a mild suggestion.
A mild suggestion. Wow.
Yeah. They engineered this entire labyrinth of state laws that were specifically designed to bypass the federal constitution, but, and this is key, without ever explicitly mentioning race.
So how did they do that? What were the actual tools?
One of the primary mechanisms was the poll tax.
Okay, paying to vote.
Right. In economic terms, requiring a fee to cast a ballot disproportionately disenfranchised, impoverished Black citizens who, you have to remember, were being deliberately locked out of the Southern economic system anyway.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's a financial barrier disguised as an administrative one.
Exactly. But the most insidious tool, by far, was the literacy test.
Right. I really want to focus on how those literacy tests actually functioned. Because reading through the sources, they weren't just like a standard reading comprehension quiz.
Oh, not as...
The sources detail how these tests were basically entirely subjective weapons wielded by local registrars.
The subjective power is the whole point. The mechanism was designed to be unfair. So a white applicant might be asked to read a really simple sentence from a primary school book.
Like See Spot Run.
Yeah, exactly. While a Black applicant could be handed this incredibly complex section of the state constitution and asked to interpret its legal nuances to the satisfaction of the registrar.
And the registrar is the one who gets to decide if your interpretation is right.
Correct. And there are these well-documented historical accounts of registrars asking literally impossible trivia questions.
Like what?
Like asking an applicant to guess the exact number of bubbles in a bar of soap.
Wait, really? A bar of soap?
Yes. Or the number of jelly beans in a glass jar on the desk.
That's insane.
It is. And if you answered wrong, which of course you would, you failed the test. You were officially deemed illiterate and you could not register to vote.
So you add that on top of the implementation of white primaries. Mm-hmm. Right. Which excluded Black voters from the only elections that actually mattered in the one-party South back then.
Yeah, the general election was a formality. The primary was where the power was.
Right. And then you add these extreme bureaucratic hurdles, like requiring vouchers of good character.
Oh, right.
Where you had to get an already registered voter to vouch for you.
Mm-hmm.
But all the registered voters were white.
It's a perfect closed loop. You can't get in without someone who's already in, and they won't let you in.
Exactly. And, you know, underneath all of this legal maneuvering was just the constant pervasive threat of physical violence and economic retaliation.
Which was the enforcement mechanism for all these laws.
Right. So the 15th Amendment existed, but local officials built this impenetrable fortress around the ballot box. I keep thinking of the 15th Amendment as like a building's architectural blueprint.
That's a good way to look at it.
Like it looks pristine on paper, but without strict building inspectors, like actual enforcement mechanisms, the actual house was completely uninhabitable for minority voters.
That is incredibly accurate.
So that brings us back to those 6,000 hours. If case-by-case lawsuits were failing, how did the federal government finally realize they needed a bigger hammer?
Well, the Department of Justice recognized this fortress existed. But, like we said, their only weapon was that case-by-case litigation. The theory was, you know, if a county is violating the 15th Amendment, we'll take them to federal court and strike down their specific literacy test.
I mean, I get the logic. You break the law, the DOJ sues you. But I still struggle to understand how a local jurisdiction could just ignore a federal court order.
Right.
If a federal judge says, hey, your literacy test is illegal, stop using it, how did local officials just keep going?
Because they didn't technically ignore the order, they sidestepped it. This is that whack-a-mole dynamic the sources talk about.
Okay, how did that work?
A federal judge would issue an injunction against a specific literacy test in a specific county. The local officials would say, okay, we comply. They would throw that piece of paper in the garbage.
Okay.
But the very next morning, the state legislature or the county board would convene and pass a brand new statute. And this one would require a slightly different test or a new character voucher requirement.
Oh, I see. So the DOJ didn't actually win a permanent victory for the voters.
Yeah.
They just invalidated one specific piece of paper.
Exactly. And the county would just print a new piece of paper, forcing the federal attorneys to start a brand new lawsuit, gather entirely new evidence, and spend another 6,000 hours litigating the new rule.
That is maddening.
Or even simpler, you know, the local registrar would just lock the doors of the office and go on vacation for 6 months.
Just leave.
Yeah. If the office is closed, no one can register. The legal evasion tactics were just infinitely adaptable and lightning fast. Meanwhile, federal litigation was agonizingly slow.
So the federal government had no proactive building inspectors, to use our analogy.
Right. The system is fundamentally broken. Lawsuits are failing.
So how do we actually get to the Voting Rights Act?
Mm.
Because reading through the history, it seems very clear that the politicians in Washington didn't just wake up one morning and decide to fix this out of the goodness of their hearts.
Oh, definitely not. It wasn't the government that realized it first. The legislative birth of the 1965 Act was entirely forced by the people on the ground.
The grassroots movement.
Exactly. We really have to look at the immense grassroots organizing that made the status quo politically unsustainable.
Yeah.
You have organizations like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC.
Right, SNCC.
The Congress of Racial Equality, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
And the day-to-day mechanics of that organizing must have been absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about figures like John Lewis, Fannie Lou Hamer, Amelia Boynton Robinson, and Martin Luther King Jr.
Giants of the movement.
Yeah, and they're going door-to-door in rural areas where just attempting to register a voter could literally result in your house being firebombed.
The physical and psychological toll was just immense. SNCC organizers were embedding themselves in communities, running these freedom schools, and just trying to teach people how to navigate those impossible literacy tests.
While facing constant harassment.
Constant, from local law enforcement, from vigilante groups. They were deliberately forcing the federal government to look at the contradiction between, you know, the American ideal and the Southern reality.
And according to the National Archives materials we looked at, the breaking point, the moment that contradiction just became impossible to ignore, was Bloody Sunday.
Yes, March 7, 1965.
The Selma to Montgomery marches.
The visual evidence of that day was just undeniable. You had peaceful, unarmed citizens attempting to march for the right to vote. And as they crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge, they were met by a literal wall of state troopers and local police.
Armed with tear gas and Nike sticks.
And bullwhips. The unprovoked brutality was captured right there by television cameras.
That media aspect is so vital to understand, because in 1965, you essentially only have three television networks.
Right. There wasn't a 24-hour news cycle.
Yeah, so when ABC interrupts his Sunday night broadcast of the movie Judgment in Nuremberg, which is quite the juxtaposition, to show this footage from Selma, millions of Americans were forced to watch this violence play out in their own living rooms.
It created an immediate, visceral moral crisis across the country.
It completely shifted the political calculus, because prior to that moment, legislative attempts to protect voting had been pretty notoriously weak.
Very weak. Congress had passed civil rights acts in 1957, 1960, and 1964.
And it's kind of ironic because the 1964 Act was monumental for ending segregation and public accommodations, but it was surprisingly toothless when it came to the ballot box.
It was a half measure. It basically just suggested that a sixth grade education should create a presumption of literacy, but it completely failed to outlaw most of those creative voter suppression tactics we talked about.
Right. But the footage from Selma changes everything. And President Lyndon B. Johnson realizes he needs a totally different approach.
He does. And the historical summaries are really fascinating here because they detail how LBJ issued this secret mandate to his attorney general, Nicholas Katzenbach.
A secret mandate?
Yeah. Okay. He told him, and this is a direct quote from the sources, to draft the goddamnedest, toughest Voting Rights Act that you can.
Wow. But why keep it a secret? Why not just come out and say that?
Because of LBJ's political calculus, the secrecy reveals just how fragile the political environment was. Johnson was attempting to construct his Great Society legislative agenda.
Right, massive programs. Medicare, Medicaid, federal education funding.
Exactly. And he knew that a vigorous public push for aggressive voting rights would absolutely infuriate Southern Democrats in Congress who held a lot of power.
He feared they would retaliate.
Right. He thought they would filibuster and destroy his entire domestic agenda.
So he had to get the wording absolutely perfect before he brought it into the light.
Exactly. So Katzenbach drafts this uncompromising bill, and it gets introduced in the Senate. And the sponsorship of it is just a masterclass in political maneuvering.
Who introduced it?
It was introduced by the Senate Majority Leader, Mike Mansfield, who was a Democrat, and the Minority Leader, Everett Dirksen, a Republican.
Okay, so totally bipartisan from the top down.
Yes. Securing Dirksen's support was literally the only way to overcome the inevitable filibuster from the Southern bloc.
Was Dirksen on board right away?
No, Dirksen was initially highly reluctant. I mean, to dive back into civil rights legislation so soon after the really bruising battle over the 1964 Act, he didn't want to do it.
So what changed his mind?
The events in Selma, That, combined with really intense lobbying by the administration and civil rights leaders, he ended up working so closely with Katzenbach to finalize the language that the legislation became informally known in Washington as the Dirksenbach Bill.
The Dirksenbach Bill. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, let's examine the actual text they came up with, because this is where the legal architecture gets truly fascinating.
It's brilliant engineering.
Yeah, like how do you write a law that actually solves that whack-a-mole problem we talked about, where local officials are just constantly changing the rules?
Right.
The sources break the 1965 Act down into two distinct tiers: the general provisions and the special provisions. So let's start with the general provisions.
Okay, so the foundational pillar of the general provisions is Section 2. This applies nationwide to every single state, county, and municipality in America, everywhere. Section 2 created a sweeping prohibition on state and local governments imposing any voting qualification, prerequisite, standard, practice, or procedure that results in a denial or abridgment of the right to vote on account of race or color.
So it's basically the ultimate baseline rule.
Exactly.
And I want to note from the sources that Congress later expanded this in 1975 to explicitly protect language minorities.
Yes, that was a huge addition.
They mandated bilingual election materials and protections for Indigenous, Asian American, Alaskan Native, and Spanish Heritage voters. So Section 2 essentially says no discrimination anywhere, ever.
Right. But there's a catch.
Which is?
A general rule still requires someone to actually file a lawsuit to enforce it.
Which brings us right back to the 6,000-hour problem.
Exactly. Congress knew that a general prohibition wasn't enough to break the really deep-rooted systems in the South. They needed a mechanism to preemptively stop the bad actors.
Preemptively.
Okay, so that is where the special provisions come in.
Yes, starting with Section 4, which is the coverage formula. I call this the math trigger. Because Section 4 is brilliant in just its cold objectivity.
It really is.
Congress didn't want to just list specific Southern states by name, right?
Yeah.
Because that would invite immediate constitutional challenges. Like, why are you picking on us?
Right. You can't just write a law saying Alabama and Mississippi are in trouble.
So instead, they created a diagnostic formula. The law stated that the special provisions would apply to any jurisdiction that met two specific criteria. First, they had to have maintained a test or device, like a literacy test, on November 1st, 1964.
Okay, so that's the first trigger.
And second, they had to have less than 50% voter registration or less than 50% voter turnout in the 1964 presidential election.
The formula was basically a highly precise dragnet.
Yeah.
If a county had a history of using subjective tests and their actual voter participation was suspiciously low, the math just caught them. They became what the law called a covered jurisdiction.
Okay, so the formula catches the bad actors. You are now a covered jurisdiction. But so what?
Right.
We just established that suing a county takes years, and they just change the rule the next day anyway. How does catching them in this mathematical net actually stop them from just printing a new literacy test?
That leads directly to the crown jewel of the act, the most powerful piece of civil rights law ever conceived. Section 5, preclearance.
Preclearance. Okay, how does it work?
If you were caught by the Section 4 formula, you lost your legal autonomy over your elections.
Completely.
Completely. You were legally barred from changing any voting rule, no matter how minute, unless you first proved to the U.S. Attorney General or a federal court in Washington, D.C., that the change had neither a discriminatory purpose nor a discriminatory effect.
Wait, let me make sure I understand the mechanics of this, because this is huge. It completely shifted the burden of proof.
Yes, exactly.
Before 1965, the DOJ had to prove a law was racist after the damage was already done. But under Section 5, the state has to prove their new law is fair before it can even be implemented.
That is the exact mechanism. It stopped the whack-a-mole game permanently.
Wow.
If a covered county wanted to, say, move a polling place from a local school to a church, they couldn't just do it. They had to submit paperwork to the federal government proving it wouldn't disproportionately burden minority voters.
Even for something that small.
Even for that. If they wanted to change the hours of an early voting location, they had to ask for permission. The federal government was no longer chasing local officials. The local officials had to come to Washington and basically beg for approval.
It is remarkably similar to putting an employee on a strict performance improvement plan.
Oh, like that analogy.
Like, if an employee, in this case the state, has a century-long documented history of terrible behavior and breaking the rules, management just revokes their autonomy.
Right.
They are put on a strict PIP where they cannot make a single major decision, they cannot alter a single process without their manager, the federal government, reviewing the proposal and signing off on it first.
That analogy captures the restriction perfectly. You forfeit the benefit of the doubt when your track record consists of systemic disenfranchisement.
Yeah, you lose the privilege of trust.
Exactly. However, the architects of the law knew that a completely rigid system might be vulnerable to constitutional challenge, so they built in escape valves.
The bail-in and bail-out mechanisms.
Yes.
I found this part of the legal engineering so compelling when reading the sources. How does a state bail out of preclearance?
The bailout provision offered a path to redemption, essentially. If a covered jurisdiction could demonstrate a clean record for a certain number of years, meaning they eliminated all discriminatory tests, fully complied with all federal laws, and actively expanded voting access, they could petition a federal court to escape the coverage formula.
So it gamified compliance.
It did. It gave local officials a tangible incentive to behave so they could eventually regain their state sovereignty.
And the bail-in provision works in reverse, right?
Correct.
So if a state wasn't caught by the original 1964 math formula, but they suddenly started passing highly restrictive discriminatory voting laws in, say, the 1970s, a federal judge could physically pull them into the preclearance requirement as a penalty.
It was a dynamic, adaptable architecture. It targeted the worst offenders, shifted the legal burden, and allowed for both punishment and rehabilitation.
So the theory is brilliant. The blueprint is aggressive. But what happens when you actually build the house?
Right. Does it work?
Yeah. Did this legal overhaul actually work in the real world?
The empirical data reveals a literal seismic shift in American society. The immediate shockwaves were unprecedented.
Give me some numbers.
By the end of 1965, the very same year the act was signed, 250,000 new black voters were registered.
In 1 year.
In months, really.
And the sources note that a full third of those new voters were registered directly by federal examiners.
Right, because the act allowed the government to send federal officials physically down to the South to take over the registration process.
Completely bypassing the local registrars who had been asking about bubbles in a bar of soap.
Exactly. They just pushed them aside. Look at the specific metrics from Mississippi. In 1964, prior to the passage of the act, black adult voter registration in Mississippi hovered at an abysmal 6.7%.
6.7%. It was practically non-existent.
But by 1969, just 4 years under the preclearance architecture, that number had surged to 66.5%.
From 6.7% to 66.5% in half a decade.
Yeah.
You are entirely rewriting the political gravity of an entire state.
You really are. And the academic studies we reviewed show that this wasn't just like a temporary surge either.
Yeah.
A 2018 study published in the Journal of Politics demonstrated that Section 5 preclearance directly increased black voter turnout by 10 to 19 percentage points over the long haul.
That's massive.
The long-term durability is the most critical finding here. A 2019 study in the American Economic Journal analyzed decades of data and found that preclearance continued to elevate minority turnout by roughly 17 percentage points right up until the year 2012.
So it fundamentally altered the structural participation rate of the country for 50 years?
Yes.
But here's a question that I think gets lost in all these statistics, and I want you listening to really reflect on this data. When we hear about voting rights, it can feel very abstract.
Sure. It sounds like high-level legal theory debated in courtrooms.
Right. But if voter turnout goes up by 17 percentage points, how does that actually change the physical reality of a community? Like, how does changing a voting law directly result in a new roof for a local public elementary school?
This is where we see the fundamental theory of representative democracy actually working in action.
Okay. Unpack that a bit.
Politicians, at their core, are highly responsive to the people who hold the power to hire and fire them.
Voters.
Right. When the demographics of the electorate change drastically, the allocation of municipal resources quickly follows.
Oh, I see.
The 2013 study in the Quarterly Journal of Economics proved exactly this mechanism. They analyzed public goods transfers and found that the implementation of the Voting Rights Act directly led to increased state funding for public education and infrastructure in localities that had higher black populations.
So if a mayor or a county commissioner suddenly realizes that a previously disenfranchised community now holds, say, 40% of the active voting power in their district,
their political survival depends on addressing that community's needs.
Right.
That politician is going to ensure those roads are paved, those streetlights are fixed, and those schools are funded. The ballot box acts as the direct lever that forces the equitable distribution of community resources.
That connects the dots perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
The literature even highlights a 2016 study showing that members of Congress who represented jurisdictions covered by preclearance began voting differently.
They did.
They became substantially more supportive of civil rights legislation on the federal level.
Mm.
Their voting records changed because their bosses, the voters, had changed.
Exactly. Furthermore, a 2020 study showed that VRA coverage actually halved the incidence of political violence.
Halved it. Just by securing the vote.
Yes. By providing a legal, structured avenue for grievances and political expression, the act reduced the structural friction that often leads to violence. The 1965 architecture demonstrated that when you secure the voting mechanism, you systematically alter the behavior of elected officials and the fundamental safety of communities.
It's a profound success story. I mean, we have this machinery, and for decades, it is working. Turnout is elevated, representation is shifting, public goods are being distributed.
Right.
But, as with all things in this deep dive, just as the act reached its peak empirical success, the legal ground beneath it began to fracture.
Yes, at the Supreme Court.
Right. And this is where we have to transition to recent jurisprudence, and we're going to objectively examine how the Roberts Court has interpreted the Voting Rights Act over the last decade and analyzed the specific legal reasoning that has altered this entire framework.
Right, keeping it strictly to the legal arguments.
Exactly. So the pivot point is the landmark 2013 case, Shelby County v. Holder.
That's the big one.
The Supreme Court issued a ruling that fundamentally dismantled the architecture we just spent the last 20 minutes praising. They ruled that Section 4, the mathematical coverage formula that determined who needed preclearance, was unconstitutional.
Chief Justice John Roberts authored the majority opinion for that case. And his reasoning really centered on two concepts, obsolete data and federalism.
Okay, break those down for me.
He argued that the coverage formula was relying on voter turnout data from 1964 and 1972. The court asserted that society had changed dramatically in the intervening 40 years.
Which, to be fair, it had.
Right. And Roberts argued that subjecting specific sovereign states to intense federal oversight based on half-century-old data violated the constitutional doctrine of the equal sovereignty of the state.
So their argument is essentially that you cannot treat Alabama as inherently more suspicious than Massachusetts in 2013 based on things that happened when Lyndon Johnson was president.
Exactly. That's the core of the ruling.
But by striking down Section 4, they effectively paralyzed Section 5. Right?
Completely.
Preclearance still exists in the text of the law, but without the mathematical formula to dictate who it applies to, the federal government has no authority to actually enforce it.
It's like having a lock on a door but throwing away the key. The immediate reaction on the ground following the Shelby decision is heavily documented in our sources.
What happened?
Well, without the shield of preclearance requiring prior approval, previously covered states rapidly pushed forward an array of new voting procedures.
The sources list these specific changes. Jurisdictions immediately instituted strict voter identification laws. They initiated aggressive purges of their voter registration rolls.
Yes.
In fact, a 2020 study noted a massive, statistically significant surge in voter purges in these specific geographic areas post-Shelby.
Right, because nobody was stopping them beforehand anymore.
They also moved or closed polling locations, often with very little public notice, creating massive bottlenecks on Election Day.
The primary mechanism of protection was just gone. The burden of proof shifted back. The federal government and civil rights organizations no longer had the power to block these laws before they took effect.
So we returned entirely to the pre-1965 era of reactive case-by-case litigation.
Yes, unfortunately.
But let me play devil's advocate here and push back on that a bit because I want to make sure I understand the legal landscape. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. That sweeping, nationwide prohibition against racial discrimination that applies everywhere. That was not struck down in Shelby, right?
Correct. Section 2 is still active law.
So if Section 2 still exists and prohibits discrimination nationwide, why do voting rights advocates view the loss of the Section 4 coverage formula as a death blow?
Because of the timeline of justice.
The timeline.
Yeah. Section 2 is inherently reactive. It requires litigation after a potentially discriminatory law has already been implemented.
Okay.
It requires plaintiffs, usually the DOJ or civil rights groups, to gather immense amounts of data, secure funding, file a lawsuit, and engage in a protracted legal battle that can stretch on for years.
While the law is already in place.
Exactly. Meanwhile, the challenge voting law remains entirely in effect. It could govern multiple election cycles before a judge finally issues a ruling. Preclearance stopped the harm from occurring in the first place. Section 2 only attempts to clean up the wreckage long after the election results are certified.
Oh, wow. So we are essentially right back to the 6,000-hour problem.
We really are. And beyond the timeline issue, The Supreme Court has also been narrowing the scope of what Section 2 can actually accomplish.
The sources mentioned a couple of recent cases here.
Yeah. In 2021, the court ruled in Brnovich v. DNC, which significantly weakened the application of Section 2 when challenging rules that disproportionately impact minority voters, like restrictions on ballot collection or out-of-precinct voting.
And then, according to the NAACP Legal Defense Fund analysis, we have the recent 2026 decision in Louisiana v. Calais.
Right.
Explain that one, because it seems really complex.
It is. This ruling dramatically increased the legal requirements necessary to bring a vote dilution claim under Section 2.
I want to pause on that term, vote dilution, because we haven't defined how that actually works. We usually hear about gerrymandering. How does a state actually dilute a minority vote using district lines?
The mechanism is typically referred to as cracking and packing.
Cracking and packing. Okay, how does that work?
So, if a state legislature is drawing a new map for congressional districts and they want to dilute the power of a specific minority group, they can pack as many of those voters as possible into one single district.
Okay, so that group will win that one seat overwhelmingly.
Yes, but their influence is entirely removed from all the surrounding districts. They get one seat, but they could have influenced three.
I see. And what's cracking?
Alternatively, the legislature can crack that community. They draw lines right through their neighborhoods to divide them across four different districts,
ensuring they remain a perpetual minority in all of them.
Exactly, making them unable to elect a candidate of their choice anywhere.
And the Supreme Court has previously ruled that partisan gerrymandering, drawing those exact same lines just to help Republicans or Democrats win more seats, is considered a political question that federal courts cannot intervene in, right?
Correct. It's perfectly legal under federal law to draw a map to crush your political opponents based purely on party.
And that creates a massive evidentiary hurdle for civil rights groups.
Huge. Because in Louisiana v. Calais, the court ruled that vote dilution claims under Section 2 must be entirely decoupled from permissible partisan gerrymandering.
I didn't do that.
That's the problem. They made it exceptionally difficult for plaintiffs to prove that a map was drawn specifically to dilute minority voting power based on race, rather than simply being a legal, ruthless partisan gerrymander.
Because race and political affiliation often overlap so significantly in modern voting data.
Exactly. If Black voters overwhelmingly vote for one party, how do you prove the map makers were targeting their race and not just their party? The court said you have to prove it's race, not party, which is incredibly difficult.
The reaction from the dissenting justices was fierce on this one.
Very fierce.
Justice Elena Kagan wrote a dissent in Calais describing the trajectory of these decisions as the, quote, now completed demolition of the Voting Rights Act.
It represents a fundamental contraction of federal oversight. I mean, we have transitioned from the apex of proactive federal intervention under Section 5 to a contemporary environment where federal courts are highly restricted in their ability to intervene in state election procedures.
Which is exactly why this issue has left the courts and returned to the legislature.
Yes.
Lawmakers aren't just reading these Supreme Court opinions and giving up. They're attempting a massive architectural renovation to rebuild the machinery in a way that satisfies the court's specific critiques.
Right. They're trying to write a new law that survives the Roberts Court.
This brings us to the modern legislative response, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act.
A very significant piece of proposed legislation.
According to the tracking resources from the Human Rights Campaign, this legislation was most recently reintroduced in the 119th Congress in 2025. Representative Tara Sewell is leading the effort in the House, alongside Senators Dick Durbin and Raphael Warnock in the Senate.
The primary objective of H.R. 14 and S. 2523 is to patch the holes left by Shelby and basically modernize the protections.
So if the Supreme Court's main issue with the old preclearance formula was that it relied on 1964 data, how does the modern John Lewis Act actually fix the math?
They engineered a rolling coverage formula.
Rolling?
Yeah. Instead of relying on a static date in the 1960s, the Modern Act proposes determining which states are subjected to preclearance based on a recent documented pattern of voting rights violations over the preceding 25 years.
Oh, that makes total sense. It creates a moving window of accountability.
Exactly.
If a state has a completely clean record for the last 25 years, they remain sovereign and autonomous.
Right.
But if a state has repeatedly been sued and found guilty of voting discrimination in recent decades, the formula mathematically pulls them into federal oversight. It directly neutralizes Chief Justice Roberts' complaint about obsolete data.
It creates a highly responsive diagnostic tool. You can't argue it's obsolete if the data is from the last two decades.
That's really clever legal engineering.
It is. Now, the second major pillar of the John Lewis Act addresses the modern tactics of voter suppression. It implements a strict 180-day public notice requirement for any significant changes to voting procedures, district boundaries, or polling locations.
The sources refer to this as a sunlight provision. And I think the best way to understand this is to compare it to a university syllabus.
Okay, let's hear it.
Let's say you have a professor who wants to change the format of the final exam. They're perfectly allowed to do that. They have the authority over the classroom. But a no surprise exams policy dictates that they must give the students fair warning well in advance so nobody is caught off guard on the morning of the test.
That is the exact intent. The 180-day rule forces transparency.
Right.
It prevents local officials from quietly moving a highly trafficked polling location 3 days before a major election or sending out thousands of voter purge notices at the 11th hour when it is too late for voters to fix the errors.
So if a state wants to alter voter ID requirements or redraw maps, they must do it in the broad daylight of public scrutiny.
Exactly. It provides civil rights organizations with sufficient time to analyze the data and file a lawsuit if they think the changes are discriminatory.
It slows the machinery down just enough to allow for oversight.
Yes. And the third major component of the proposed legislation focuses on physical presence.
Physical presence.
Yeah.
Like sending people.
Yes. It aims to expand the federal government's authority to send independent observers to specific jurisdictions where there is a substantial documented risk of discrimination, particularly during early voting periods and on election day.
So reestablishing a physical federal presence is designed to deter intimidation tactics at the polls.
Right, and ensure that the administrative process of voting, from checking IDs to processing provisional ballots, is conducted fairly and according to the law.
While this intense battle is playing out in the halls of Congress, I think it's crucial to note that the states are not just waiting around for a federal fix.
No, they aren't.
The sources point out that in the absence of a robust national framework, several states are actually stepping into the vacuum by passing state-level voting rights acts.
That's a relatively new trend.
Yeah. New York, California, Virginia, and others have enacted their own localized versions of the VRA, implementing state-level preclearance mechanisms to protect voters within their borders.
Which is a fascinating development because it represents a profound fragmentation of voting rights.
Fragmentation, that's a good word for it.
We are shifting from a unified baseline federal standard back to a decentralized patchwork of state-by-state protections.
Which means your fundamental access to the ballot box increasingly depends on the political makeup of the specific state legislature where you reside.
Exactly. Your rights vary depending on your zip code.
So let's trace the full arc of the journey we've just taken today. We started in the aftermath of the Civil War with the constitutional promise of the 15th Amendment.
Right.
We saw how that promise was systematically strangled by subjective literacy tests, asking about soap bubbles and physical violence, leading directly to the bloodshed on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma.
And then we analyzed the brilliant legal engineering of the 1965 Act, how the architecture preclearance completely shifted the burden of proof onto the states, resulting in a statistically undeniable expansion of democracy and a more equitable distribution of public resources for minority communities.
And we tracked how the Supreme Court decisions over the last decade dismantled that specific proactive architecture, forcing us back into a legal landscape where discrimination must be fought reactively, thousands of hours at a time, lawsuit by lawsuit.
Right back to where we started.
Which brings us to the current push in 2025 to rebuild the gears with the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act.
If there is one overarching takeaway to pull from all these sources, it is that voting rights are not a static, permanent achievement.
They really aren't.
They are not an exhibit sitting behind glass in a museum. They are a living, breathing, mechanical system. They are the physical gears that decide who gets a voice in governance, how your tax dollars are spent, and who ultimately wields power.
And as the history clearly demonstrates, that mechanism requires relentless maintenance, constant vigilance, and continuous adaptation just to survive.
Absolutely.
And that adaptation leads me to a final thought for you to mull over as we wrap up this deep dive. We have spent this hour talking about the history of physical suppression literacy tests, moving polling places, and human registrars making subjective decisions.
The physical barriers.
But as we move deeper into the 21st century, the battlefield is shifting entirely. Think about the era of artificial intelligence and algorithmic district drawing.
Oh, that's a whole different frontier.
We are looking at software that can process billions of data points to draw voting maps with surgical, demographic precision, isolating communities in milliseconds.
The efficiency of disenfranchisement becomes terrifyingly automated.
Exactly. If the 1965 Voting Rights Act showed us that human bias requires proactive monitoring and federal preclearance to keep the system fair, what happens next?
That's the big question.
When discrimination is no longer a poll tax or a closed office door, but is instead buried deep within lines of proprietary code and opaque machine learning models, how will future voting rights acts need to evolve? We spent half a century figuring out how to regulate human registrars. How long will it take us to figure out how to regulate the machines?
Something to really think about.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the unseen architecture of our democracy. Keep questioning the blueprints, everyone. We will see you next time.